Okay. So yeah, maybe we should continue. We're a bit short on time here. So I now want to quickly introduce the part of the UML back notation that I'm going to use in this presentation. And by the way, there are some handouts for the slides if someone has got any yet, so you can take them. So the idea is now that you can, you should be able to use the different, UML diagrams which concern different phases in the development process and use them in the context of this UML spec notation. So and usually one begins with the system design using so-called use case diagrams. And so you can see an example here. These are really just very abstract diagrams where you simply specify the interaction between different parts of the system and users of the system, and where you can specify certain kinds of use cases. In this case, well, this is simply a customer who wants to buy some goods from a business. And well, there's not much information in this kind of diagram, of course, so there's also not much you can say about security requirements at this point, but you can simply include the requirement which you will want to have eventually as some kind of stereotype. But this is the tech change stereotype, meaning in this case that the electronic transaction which is supposed to be implemented here is supposed to be implemented in a way which ensures that all participants in the transaction will not will remain secure. So there's no, for example, if the customer buys some goods and pays in advance, he actually wants to get the goods and not be cheated in any way, and the other way around for the business. So, of course, at this abstract level, you simply insert this as a requirement, as a stereotype, and there's not much happening now yet. But then at the next step, well, maybe you should show the example first. So you may want to specify this transaction in more detail, for example, using a so-called activity diagram, which allows you to specify the different activities that are supposed to be implemented in a system. And the notation, if you don't know it already, is really much like a state machine. So in that sense, I mean, generally you can say that the UML notation really is built on existing notations which have been existed for quite a long time, so it's not really so much new if you really look at it. So this activity diagram is essentially a state machine where you can, however, partition the state space into the different control flows for the different participants in a certain system specification. In this case, if you worry about this business process where there's an electronic transaction where a customer buys a certain good from a business, you know, as the customer in the business, you specify this workflow in this state machine, this activity diagram, and here you can now use this fake change stereotype from the use case diagram, now actually has a technical meaning. And this works in a way which is actually similar to these authentication correspondence properties, which we saw in the talk by Annie yesterday. Here you also want, one way of doing this is to specify a certain point in the execution of this state machine where in a way that whenever there's this activity is executed, then eventually there's another activity which will also have to be executed in any complete execution of the system. Meaning that in this example, if the customer paid for the goods beforehand, then eventually he either wants to be able to pick up the goods which he ordered over maybe a website, or he wants to be able to reclaim the money from the from the business, maybe by making use of a trusted third party or something. So how this is implemented in the next step is not specified here. This is just the workflow which should take place. Of course, we can see that this security requirement can only hold for systems where the adversary is not able to stop them completely, because otherwise you would need to, or at least otherwise you would need to have a fallback to some kind of recovery mechanism. So anyway, this is just an example where you can use this kind of stereotype, this kind of the exchange requirement to make a technical technical requirement on this the execution of this kind of activity diagram state machine. And this you can then automatically verify using the tool support that is available for this notation. And of course, well, you still have to define this security requirement generally. I just explained it at the end of an example. And of course, this has to be defined in a way which is refers to the underlying formal execution model of this diagram. So I will not spend too much time about talking formal semantics for UML diagrams, because that would be really a different topic, and I don't have so much time. But with all the next examples I will show, it's always important to remember that we need some kind of formal execution model, some formal semantics for the different UML diagrams, against which you can firstly formalize these kind of security requirements, and then secondly analyze them automatically or verify them automatically using things like theorem provers. I will actually define this or explain this in detail with respect to one of these security requirements and with respect to a certain kind of system which you may want to analyze in the end of the part today. But for this general overview, I will more or less remain on the informal level, but you should keep in mind that all of this has a formal underlying level. So this is sort of the beginning of where you could start, try to use UML. Firstly, define general requirements and use case diagram, then break this down into workflows or business processes. And the next step is that you want to actually implement these workflows in a system. And for that, again, you have to firstly think about what the general architecture is supposed to be. If this is going to be an internet-based system or whatever. And this also you have to include in the system to be later able to analyze the system with respect to the level of physical security arising from this architecture. And for this you have different kinds of stereotypes, such as internet, which you can attach to different links or nodes in a so-called deployment diagram. I think we have an example here, yes. This is another kind of diagram in the UML notation, which allows you simply to specify that you have different kinds of nodes in the system, so these boxes, which may be connected by communication links. These are the lines on the one hand, so this is the physical layer, and you can also include the logical structure of the system in terms of components by having these component models, which are these rectangles with these double rectangles on the left. These may also be connected by so-called communication dependencies, these broken arrows, and this is sort of the relations on the logical level. And of course, for every communication dependency, you should have a communication link, otherwise it's not going to work. Also here you can then include the information what kind of physical links this is going to be, such as internet links, and maybe also what are the physical characteristics of the nodes. So maybe this may be a smart card, implemented on a smart card, and this can also be security relevant. And so for this purpose, you have different kinds of stereotypes. So encrypted would be encrypted internet links, such as the virtual private network links. and then you can attach that to the link and the nodes. And then you have all these different stereotypes, and again, you want to be able to consider different kinds of adversary models. For each of them, you have this set of threads, which is defined within the UMSSEC notation, which arises from the physical security of this kind of physical entity. And you can define it in this sort of a table. Part of this is given on the slide here. This is, of course, not from everything, it's just an excerpt. And this here for the default adversary model, or the default adversary, where you assume that this is an external adversary with modest strength. So an adversary who can attack unprotected internet connections, because that's relatively easy to do, but it's not able to break encryption. You would have the definition here that for internet links, the adversary can indeed read and insert data. For an encrypted internet link, you may say you are able to delete data by bringing down a network server, but not able to read or insert data, assuming that he doesn't have the corresponding encryption keys. And then the default adversary would also not be able to access a LAN connection, because he's an external adversary, and also not access a smart card, because that's supposed to be tamper-resistant. But of course you can define many different kinds of adversary models, all for the use of this approach, and also if you want to extend the approach. And for each of these, then the automated the tools that analyze the specification with respect to these adversaries will take this information and will construct the logical formula that has to be verified with respect to this kind of threat model. Was a question? Yeah?
Yeah. With the encrypted stereotypes, do you also have maybe duplicate rule? Because the tool might be able to duplicate in encrypted messages. Typically, if you send twice, you have some encrypted with session keys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in this case, this is encrypted. Well, the assumption, I think, is here rather high level, and this kind of problems you would consider on a more detailed level. If you maybe consider the security protocol, and you will see that in the next example. But in this level, you would actually assume that the encryption, the secure link, is done in a way which maybe include a transaction number, a sequence number, which would allow this kind of replay attack. But well, this is here just an assumption. You have to make sure, you have to keep in mind that this level is just an assumption, and you have to still make sure that the security protocols you use actually live up to this requirement, and you can do this with other stereotypes later. So this is what it is, yeah. And so the next thing you can do is, well, again, in this example, on the one hand, again, you want to compare the logical level of the system with the physical level, not only to make sure that whenever you want to have a communication, you actually have a link to enable that, but also to make sure that, firstly, you can, on the logical level, you can include certain security requirements, such as a certain communication dependency is supposed to provide secrecy for the data that is communicated along the communication dependency. And secondly, you have this physical information, which I already mentioned or explained. And then, of course, you want to make sure that at the level of at this abstract level of the system architecture, there isn't a problem there yet. Of course, this is still very abstract. And this means, so this is the so-called secure link stereotype. At this point, it simply means that if you consider the threat scenario, which I defined on the previous slide, this table which associates certain atomic threats with the adversary models, and if you have certain security requirements, then these security requirements should not be broken by the threats that arise from the physical layer. So, for example, if you have a secrecy requirement, then it should not be the case that with respect to the different adversary models and with respect to the stereotype which labels the link that you look at and that the dependency goes across, that there should be a risk arising from that link. Because if you can read information, then this will not be a secret. I mean, assuming that you actually read the information itself, you don't just read the encrypted message. And this was similar for the other requirements, such as integrity. That goes the other way along. So this example, well, you can wonder whether this is actually provided here. So, okay, you have an internet link here, and you have a secrecy requirement. Any ideas, any opinions on that? Is this consistent, having to have this kind of security requirement and to have an unprotected internet communication link? Actually, I just said that before, so I think you already know that, but you don't want to say it because it's easy, right? Okay, no objection, so I assume this is true. Okay, yeah, it was really easy. Of course, it's violated because, as I just said, if you send unprotected data over internet links, then the secrecy will not be provided. Right? I mean, this is pretty trivial, but it's still convenient to have this on this very abstract level. I mean, this is not really verification in any serious sense, but it's good to keep track of this information and to have this kind of consistency check that you actually know what you want and you know how to get it to it, you know. This policy means, okay, this is not, internet link does not support a secrecy requirement. This simply means you have to make use of a security protocol here. And this is an automatic way of pointing this out to anyone who might miss this. Of course, it's trivial in this example, but if you have a really, in practice, you have really big specifications and architectures, and it may be not so obvious to see which parts are contained in which other parts, which again are supposed to be secret, secure as components, such as a smart card, and you may have some, you may miss something there. So this may be useful anyway. So a different kind of consistency check, and now not between the different layers, like logical and physical layer, but within the data structure. If you look at now, in this case, the class structure of the system, there you can have class models, and you can define attributes, you can define methods which can be called by an object at another object. And here you can then also include security requirements on the specific data. So you can, in this example, exactly the one that the key generator who needs a certain random number from the random generator in order to generate the key. Of course, in order for the key to be secret, the random number also has to be secret, assuming that there is a deterministic algorithm which constructs the key from the random seed. So at this point, it's also just a consistency check where you can make sure that whenever the key generator needs the secrecy of the random value, this is actually provided by the random generator. So, and this also, again, you have to firstly define generally in a formal way, which can then be checked by the support. And this is sort of informally sketched here in this requirement here on the bottom. So this is something which you can also easily verify. There's not much verification effort connected with that again, but it's quite also quite a useful thing to have. And in this example, again, probably easy to see. Any opinions? This is actually provided here. So we have a secrecy requirement at the random method, which is supposed to be called at the random generator. And then the random generator, well, the point is here, there's actually no security requirement stated at all, right? I mean, the point is you have to state them at each of the objects separately, and so here you don't have any security requirement at all, and therefore again, in this example, this overall security requirement of having a secure data structure is actually violated. So because the random generator doesn't actually offer this kind of protection for the random method. So you can use it as some kind of rely guarantee specification, but in this case also still on the static level of the system. So the key generator wants to rely on the fact that the random number remains secret, but unfortunately in this case the random generator is not willing to guarantee that, and therefore this overall requirement is violated. And of course we will have to verify in the next step with respect to the behavioral specification whether this is actually realized. If the random generator would claim that this remains secret, we would still have to check that this is really supported by the behavioral specification. And this is what we get to now, is the sort of considering the behavioral specifications, and here I give two kinds of examples for important security properties, which both of which we've actually seen in the previous lectures. And the first of them is the secure information flow requirement. So Andrei talked about these kind of things. And so I think I don't have to explain it in much detail. The general idea is again that you want to prevent even an indirect or a partial flow of information from or off trusted or sensitive data from trusted parts of the system to untrusted parts. This is again can be formalized with respect to the underlying form execution model of the relevant UML libraries. And what you need here is then of course the behavioral specification such as the state chart here. This is again really just a state machine in a particular location. And here, another example, I don't know if you can actually read the writing from everywhere, but well, you can have these handouts here, so you can maybe read in the handouts. So here you have a customer account, maybe for a web-based e-commerce system, where the customer can log into the system and can buy some goods, and there is a customer, well, there's an account which keeps track of the amount of money that was stored so far when previously calling this website. And the requirement now is, well, firstly, or another functional feature is that if the customer has spent more than 1,000 of some currency, then there should be some extra service provided by the system. So and this is reflected in the stage machine. The first stage, no extra service when the customer starts with being a customer. After having bought enough goods, there will be some extra service. And now, okay, you have certain secrecy requirements or privacy in this case. The customer doesn't want everyone to see how much money he spent on the website for whatever reason. So we have the secrecy requirement that this money attribute is supposed to remain secret. And you have, or in this case, this example was a general no-downflow requirement that not even a partial piece of information about the secrecy requirement is supposed to leak out of the system to the untrusted participant. So the point is then that, the question is this actually fulfilled in this specification? And to answer this question, you again have to consider what are the different, what is the input-output interface, what are the different methods that you can call in the system? And the point now is that there are not only methods which allow you to read and write this money attribute, which of course has to be there, because this component is to be used by the context of the system context, which has to be able to increase the amount of money spent and also be able to read the amount of money to determine whether there should be an extra service granted or not. And of course, so this is also required to be secret in the specification, these two methods. But then you also have a search method, this Rx method, which by which the context of this control list would be able to determine whether there is some extra service supposed to be provided to the customer. And, well, okay, to sort of get to the answer of this question, as you can see here, this method is not required to, the result, the return value of this method is not required to remain secret for whatever reason, because it's not supposed to, not assumed to be sensitive or whatever, or maybe someone forgot about it. And what you can find out now using this kind of check, using the tools, is that well, that this is actually this overall requirement is actually violated now again. And the reason now is of course that you can get some hard information via this RX method, which is not assumed to be secret, and then the piece of information whether the customer has already spent more than 1,000 or not, because this is what this extra service method gives you back as a, well, as a result. Maybe if the the node service, the return value is the return value is false, there are no extra service, and otherwise it's true, there should be a piece of it. So, and this something in this simple example you could still see by just looking at it, but obviously, I mean, in practice, these specifications are much larger, and there it's usually not possible to see this with a bare eye in a way. And that's why it's useful to also have some proofy points here. And the other kind of security requirement, which is sort of which we've also seen already, this is the sort of there is also some kind of data security, but now incorporating cryptography. So what I showed just on the previous slide doesn't yet include cryptography, cryptographic algorithms, but you also want to have some kind of security requirement where you can reason about the use of cryptographic operations within the system context. I mean, we've already seen this in previous lectures, and so this you can also do in the context of this notation. This is an example which I will now try to explain in more detail on the next couple of slides. And here just show the overall specification. Of course you cannot read it here, and you cannot answer the question whether this is secure or not, but anyway, we will see that there's actually a bug in here, and I will explain how to use this kind of notation and the tools to find this out automatically. And hopefully also make a demo either today or probably tomorrow, because I'm still in lack of time. Well, just to mention, in this overview, just to mention another kind of stereotype, as I said, it would be nice to consider more architectural specific security requirements, and as one example, if we look at Java security, there you have in the current Java version, you have a quite a complicated security architecture which gives you a lot of powerful mechanisms such as signed, sealed, and guarded objects. But if you actually try to use them, this is really non-trivial, especially the guarded objects. So the idea there is that you can use guard objects to control access to other objects depending on certain properties at runtime. So maybe depending on the time of day, or depending on the number of previous accesses, depending on the URL from which an applet was downloaded, or depending on the signature by which the object was signed, and so on. So all of that very flexible and powerful, but really non-trivial to use correctly. And this is also something else, so I cannot really explain it in detail here now, but I just want to mention that there's another stereotype in this notation which allows you to do this to do support a correct use of this kind of mechanism. Okay, and then, you could come back and consider whether this is the requirements on this domain notation, which I gave a short partial overview on now, are actually met. And I'm trying to argue here that in each of the cases, there are supporting mechanisms in this notation that you can actually use to to address all these concerns that you would have with respect to this kind of extension. Okay, so not really much to say about that. Now another thing which would be interesting, which we have also been started to look at, is now that you have the general framework to express all these kind of different security requirements, different views on the system, and so on, it would of course be interesting to now try to relate them. You know, what happens if, for example, we have this secure links requirement, which is sort of this tells you that the architecture of the system is overall secure on the architecture level, and each of the components within the system satisfies data security. Does this mean that the system on the whole also satisfies data security? So we have some kind of hierarchical composition, we have some kind of modularity, composability, and so on. Of course, these are important questions which are already also considered with other notations. This is generally interesting, but the point that you have these different views now allows you to actually consider these different views and relate them and see whether they fit together and whether they may contradict each other and so on. And also consider refinement on your way towards the code. Of course, you could try to make the specifications more detailed first, and then you eventually want to get to the code. But of course, you have to make sure that the code then is still secure. And this is maybe slightly surprisingly also non-trivial problem to make sure that the refinement of the specification is still secure. I mean, this is something you would want to have, but in some approaches in the past, this was actually violated. So notorious refinement problem, which has actually also been considered in the academic literature. And this, all of these you can now also consider this context. And we've also been done some work in that direction, and if I have some time tomorrow, maybe I will try to talk a bit more about that. This should have been now the break, so I'm hopefully out of the time span now. But anyway, so what I was trying to make a point with respect to this general notation is, okay, you want to use an extension of an industrial use notation to be able to consider security requirements within the development process. And also to be able to relate this later, so I will talk a little bit about that later, also to relate this with the source code and the configuration data. And this I just discussed just now. So now, quickly, we want to try to get as far as possible with respect to the underlying security analysis framework. Actually, the next couple of slides I can go through relatively quickly, because this is really what we've been seeing a couple of times already in this school. So again, based on this old Dolapiao model of this idea that you have an adversary model who can do certain things with respect to certain communication links and certain nodes in the system. So I don't really have to explain this because we've seen this already. To model this adversary together with the formal execution model of the system to then be able to verify the specification with respect to the security requirements which are formalized relative to these adversary models. And again, as we've also seen before, here in order to make this automated analysis possible, keys are viewed abstractly as symbols, and algorithms are viewed as abstract operations in some kind of term algebra. So this means you can only decrypt if you have the right keys, and you can only decompose with the messages which you know already, and so on. And of course, as was pointed out already also, there are some attacks which you cannot find this way. You can only, these are for example statistical attacks, traffic analysis, and so on. But as I will make clear, hopefully, also on the part tomorrow, there are too many security flaws which you can already find this way. So it's a worthwhile approach anyway. And the advantage is that you can actually be automated here. which you couldn't, you probably couldn't otherwise if you had to integrate more information. So, well, some more notation, which we've actually already seen yesterday also. So any define that in, well, just look different to the XML notation. I might be a little different with sort of more mathematical notation, but it's the same thing. So you have certain basic data types, such as atomic data, keys, and variables, which you want to use in your specification, maybe of a protocol or whichever else kind of system. And you can then define the expressions, which can be changed around as arguments of the methods, for example, or which can be assigned to attributes by taking atomic values and putting them together with these abstract operations such as concatenation. Well, you can encrypt data, you can decrypt, you can sign, you can extract information from the signature and so on. And there are also inverse keys. So a good key, if you consider asymmetric communication encryption, and you also want to be able to unpack a concatenation, which you do using the head and tail operations, for example. And on this term algebra, which you define this way, again, as we saw yesterday, you have to pose certain equations. The obvious ones, I mean, if you encrypt something and decrypt it again, you want to get back your original plain text. Similarly, with verifying signatures and retrieving information from concatenating expressions. And you can actually consider other kind of interesting laws in this context, and also with the tool support, which I will present later. Because we're using a sort of field prover, which allows you to incorporate additional equations rather easily. Interesting things would be there, maybe consider XOR operation and so on. But I don't have the time to talk about that now. But this is actually also one of the things which is currently being considered, not of course only in this approach, but generally in formal methods applied to security. So this is the general Gödel model. We've seen this before, just as a picture. And I don't actually have to expand it in detail because we know this now from the previous lectures. The idea is if you have a system which is distributed between a part A and B, and they want to communicate, and if, for example, there's an internet connection between them, you have to assume that the adversary has a complete control over the communication link. And so whatever messages A wants to send to B, the adversary can intercept and possibly send on to B, or maybe not. And B may send something back, the adversary will get that information, will build up his knowledge set, which is given in the bottom of the slide, and also by decrypting information using the associated decryption keys, and may send on some information to the other guy, which may actually be different from the one which was intended. So we have seen this before, just the general idea. So I mean, this is, so in principle, the adversary can control the communication whenever you have something like the internet communication link. But of course, as I pointed out already, with this notation, you can also consider other kinds of threat scenarios. And the way this underlying verification framework then works is actually also similar to what Andy mentioned yesterday, so but using a different kind of tool now. Here again, you want to keep track of the knowledge that is accumulated by the adversary in its interaction with the system. So there's a knowledge check, which we saw on the previous slide, actually, and this may increase with an interaction with the system. And you can then say, for example, that a certain piece of information remains secret throughout the execution of the system if the attackers of the type that you want to consider do not receive this message in without protection in their knowledge set. Some easy examples, which I'm sure you're also familiar with by now. Okay, here's the first case. Secrecy of n is not preserved because k is the encrypted key. K is then embedded, assuming this is symmetric encryption. In the second case, this is actually preserved. And while slightly more typical example, if you had a sort of hybrid scheme where you send the session key encrypted under a public key first, and then you, in this example, you get back the information encrypted under the session key, this gets more interesting. So this is actually not preserved secrecy against an active adversary because you could simply insert your own session key there. But if it would in principle be preserved against a passive adversary. Of course, this is not a good way of designing the system to assume that maybe, hopefully, the adversary may just be passive. But this shows that you really have to worry about the actual capabilities of the adversary. And in some cases, the system may be secure against certain adversaries and may be insecure against others. Okay, now towards the tool support, which we want to use for analyzing the Lumet diagrams with respect to this kind of formalization. Again, now the idea is that you want to approximate the knowledge that the adversary may accumulate. The reason why you want to approximate it is firstly performance, and secondly also some theoretical bounds on automatically verifying security requirements. So some people have shown that security requirements in general are undecidable, so it would be a bit, of course the question is, how does this theoretical result of undecidability relate to the practical question of having getting back a result for a given specification within an acceptable amount of time? There's always a certain mismatch between these two views, but anyway, the undecidability points out that these properties are really, really difficult, and so maybe a good idea to approximate these properties and thereby hope that you get an efficient automated verification routine. But of course, you have to make sure that you approximate it from the right side. You don't want to under-approximate it because you may miss bugs, but you want to over-approximate it in a way that you may have false positives, but you will get the bugs that are contained at least on the in your model. This can be done in the kind of formalization that I will shortly explain on the next couple of slides, arising from the UML specification. So firstly, what you need is you design a predicate node, which is supposed to keep track of the knowledge that the adversary accumulates. You need the equations, which I already mentioned, on the cryptographic expressions, which I define. These you can simply define as axioms in the theorem prover that we're using here. And then for this, considering the fact that the adversary can also apply cryptographic operations himself, assuming he has the corresponding keys and so on, you need these kind of formulas to keep track of that. So for example, if the adversary knows two expressions, P1 and P2, he will also know the concatenation of the two expressions because he can simply put them together, and he will know the encryption of the one encryption, of the one expression by the other, and so on. And you can also, of course, unpack concatenations and so on. So this is really, this just means that the adversary can apply the cryptographic operations himself using the knowledge that he knows already. And then, okay, now you actually want to generate first a logic formula from the UML specification. For example, from a sequence diagram like this one. So this is, in this case, the protocol which I showed already, this TLS variant, or rather the core part of it, because I wanted to fit it on one slide. It doesn't mean that you can only deal with small protocols like that, so tomorrow we also see bigger ones, but just for explanation, this is really a small protocol where you have three messages. In the first one, the initialization, the client sends none, his own public key, and a self-signed certificate to the server, where the certificate contains his own identity and his public key, signed with his own public key. The server sends back a signature which assigns his own private key, which contains the session key and the non, which was received earlier, and the signature is again then encrypted by the public key of the client, and also he sends the certificate issued by the certification authority, which binds his own identity to his own public key. So this is rather standard in principle, and then the client checks that the relevant equations actually hold, so that if you extract from the second argument of this method, you extract using the public key of the certification authority, you extract the content of the signature, then the first component could actually be the expected identity, and also you want to verify the non which was sent earlier to the server. This is really still the same. So in terms of notation, it would show that this red one, for example, is supposed to denote the first argument of the red method. And so here, while I deviate from the traditional notation for security protocols by making this kind of distinction between the messages that are sent out by a participant and the messages that are received. So the messages sent out by the server is simply the signature encrypted under the public key, but the message received by the client is here just the variable rest one. And when you execute this diagram, then depending on what the adversary individual does, this variable rest one may actually be assigned to the expected value which was sent out by the server, or it may be assigned something completely different, because in this situation we assume, because this is an internet link, that the adversary is again in complete control over of the communication. And so this is we make this distinction to be then able to analyze which kind of value actually client received and what happens if the client receives something else from what was intended, which is actually the core problem which has to be solved when analyzing, for example, security for the call. So I hopefully sort of explain how this works. Are there any questions about this security protocol, about how this is supposed to function? Because my sort of ambitious goal was to set an exercise for tomorrow to find the bug in it. So it's of course extremely ambitious, but for anyone who really wants to do it and has not completely understand the protocol now, you can either ask now or ask me later until tonight or something. And the challenge would be for anyone here to find the bug in this protocol. So I thought because this is the school, there should also be exercises. And yeah, I'm still thinking about this plan in the end. So any opinions on that? Anyway, maybe not. So we'll have an exercise at least. But I hope that in a rush I actually explained enough for you to be able to think about it. Anyway, just ask me maybe afterwards if you're interested. Okay, now secondly, of course, apart from the communication or from the behaviors presentation, we again need the physical infrastructure, which I already mentioned actually in the previous discussion, that there are two components connected by an internet link, which of course is vulnerable against the standard adversary, and this is the threat arising from this adversary model. We know this already, but this is now included in this specification. And then, we want to translate this to first order logic, to be then able to apply this automated zero approval to automatically verify the security requirements. I can only shortly sketch this here, but it's not actually so complicated. So this is part of the principle, the qua definition of this translation, assuming that you have a link in the sequence diagram which specifies that a certain participant sends a certain message to another participant, but here you have to consider that firstly the participant has to receive some other input messages, and also usually there are some conditions which have to be fulfilled so that the system will continue with its execution. If that's the case, then the other message will be sent out. So this is the general structure here. Here, for example, if the server receives a certain message and a certain condition is fulfilled, then another message is going to be sent out. And again, this is sort of common approach to formalize this, so this is not unique to our usage here, that you can translate it to an implication which says that, well, simply if the message is already known to the adversary, which is supposed to be sent to the participant, and if the condition holds, then the adversary will also know the message which is sent out by that participant, and then you sort of add these implications into each other in order to proceed with the protocol. But we should note here that by mapping these implications to each other, this means implicitly that the order of these messages are actually enforced by the protocol participants. So if the server receives firstly the exchange message before there was an initialized message, he will refuse or ignore this message. And we will come back to this point, because there's actually a flaw which arises in a situation where this wasn't actually the case. I will talk about that tomorrow. So this is how it's going to work. And for this example, the formula sort of looks like this. I'm going to explain in detail here, but well, the first message is translated into this expression here, so the adversary simply gets to know these three arguments no matter what. No precondition here, because the client sends them out initially. And for the second message, firstly the adversary has to know these three arguments which the server has to receive first in order to then send out the other message. And moreover, the condition actually has to hold, which is required here. If that's the case, then the adversary also will know the two messages sent out here. And then you have nested, you have the next implication corresponding to the third message. It should sort of make, should explain how this works in some way. And then, I think I should wrap up very quickly now. In this specification, you can now also specify the coordination between these different components. Here, in this example, this is very simple. It just simply means that the two components are iterated independently, and they wait for another message of the other participant. So that's not very interesting here, but other examples really get more complicated, and it's then really necessary to also consider this general coordination layer, not just the call protocol. And then you can also specify the security requirements. And mentioned this in the example here, in the protocol, the goal was, of course, to transmit this data by the net securely from the client to the server. So in the sense that the secrecy of this data should be preserved. And this is this requirement you can formulate in the
corresponding class diagram.
So this is not much going on here. You just say, okay, secrecy. For example, the data value S is going to remain secret. And this is also going to be used by the tools.
Or mentioning that this is what I just explained very shortly is actually the protocol which was proposed at the conference, IEEE Infocom, a couple of years ago. And well, the goal was actually come up with this variant on TLS. This is of course not TLS itself, where TLS, as you may know, is the current variant of the SSL protocol, which is used in many browsers. The reason why they came up with this variant was that they said that for the usual version, the server has to do a lot of computation. And they defined a different variation where the computation node is actually offloaded to the client to maybe prevent some sort of denial of service attacks or just to decrease the load by the server. But as I already, well, okay, firstly, you can actually generate this sort of input notation for the automated serial improver now using the tools which I will demonstrate tomorrow. And this looks like this. So this is sort of named the formula now with the input notation of this particular tool. But this is really just protocol logic. So even if you don't know the notation, then don't worry. And this is just the, in principle, the formula which I just explained. Plus, in addition, something which I'm not showing here, or actually the formulas which I mentioned earlier concerning the recombination of messages and so on. So this is really only what I explained so far will have to be included in the input file which we have to give to the automated serial improver. And this is really, that's really all. Right? I mean, so the specification in itself, I think, is actually quite intuitive if you were able to read the notation. And you could argue, well, okay, maybe if developers want to use first order logic to start with, maybe they can use this. But unfortunately, many people in practice, if they hear logic, then they will run away as quickly as possible. So that's again the motivation for using this sort of UML as a notation. But the analysis again happens on the logical level, of course. And this, if you put this into the tool now, then what you get out is actually two bounds. Now you have to remember that well, the question we ask to the tool is actually whether you can derive nodes of S from the formulas which were generated by the protocol. And if you can derive this predicate, then this means that the adversary will get to know the secret S. So in fact, if you make a proof found, then this is actually bad news. This doesn't mean that the protocol is proved to be secure, but it's shown that the secret is leaked actually. What we would have liked to see is the result. This particular tool would say model found, meaning that it finds a counterexample to the theorem it was supposed to prove. And this would mean that it is not possible to derive nodes of S from the generated formulas. And this means that the protocol is actually secure against this security requirement. Of course, there's also a third possibility, namely that either the tool doesn't terminate in a sufficient short amount of time, or that it gives back the result. I cannot give a solution. And this is, then you don't know. This is inherent in the fact that security requirements are undecidable. This may happen for theoretical reasons. But with the examples we considered, this didn't actually happen in all cases. So you can certainly construct specific examples where this will happen, but hopefully it doesn't happen a lot throughout our experience at least. Okay, so as I said already, in the cure, it didn't deliver what was supposed to deliver, and not only the authors, also reviewers apparently missed that fact. Because it was put forward at that conference. And you can now generate the attack also with another tool. You could, of course, look at the proof tree generated by the serial prover, but while I do not read this at the moment because it's a lot of data, it's quite a sophisticated prover. This could be available in the future, but at the moment we still use the second tool with protobase, which simply generates the attack. Of course, you may wonder why we don't just use this one, but the point is that this is not as powerful. You have to constrain your search space, so this is really the way you use it, is really closer to bounded model checking. And there you have certain constraints which you have to make. And this means you don't have to, in the case of this theorem, you want. And yeah, what is the exercise for the model? What is the effect actually? And then also, if someone really wants to think about it, how can you fix it? It's actually quite an easy fix. You simply have to introduce one atomic data item in one of the messages in the protocol. So very easy one to fix. So your challenge to try to do it is small. And if you extend it, you have any questions for the protocol. And now we are really a bit overrun. Sorry about that. It was a slow at the beginning. So just wrap up. So this is what we were supposed to learn today. And tomorrow I will continue with some examples actually taken from industrial projects, and where there are interestingly also a couple of exciting effects in there. So actually this is the approach. So any more questions at this point? No questions at the moment, so you can just ask me whenever I'm running around, or today, tomorrow. Also another organizational thing, I put the slide handouts there, in case you didn't get them. I also have some questionnaires here. I would be interested in feedback on the tutorial, apart from the fact that I was too slow in the beginning, which you may of course still write down to remind me. But if you I don't know if I should try to distribute it now maybe. So if you either fill them in now or maybe tomorrow during the second half, I will also be always be interested in improving the presentation here also. And return it to me whenever, either today or tomorrow. So I guess that's the part for today. Again, sorry about overrunning. I will try to be faster tomorrow. Okay, well, thank you.